This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Paul Finley served 22 years in Congress, representing part of Central Illinois. He passed away last week at the age of 98. We'll look back at the career of the sometimes controversial lawmaker. The state of Illinois adopted an idea called budgeting for results nearly a decade ago. How's it working? We'll take a look. Students have gotten involved in an effort to make changes on a dangerous stretch of road.
We need persistent people continuing to push for these projects and push for improvement.
We'll hear from a state's attorney about some of the challenges with the new recreational marijuana law, and we'll check in with a Southern Illinois town that's making preparations to get an accurate census count next year. That and a whole lot more coming up this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, students are getting back to class, and they're now required to participate in active shooter drills. Some fear they may be doing more harm than good. We'll have a report. We'll also hear how some young people are becoming civically engaged to push for improvements to a highway. And we'll visit Carbondale as the Southern Illinois community prepares for the next census. That and more this hour on Statewide. This month saw the passing of the former Illinois Congressman Paul Finley. The Republican from Jacksonville served 22 years in the U.S. House. Eventually, he was defeated by Democrat Dick Durbin, who's now a U.S. Senator. Upon news of Finley's death, Durbin issued a statement calling him an exceptional public servant and a friend. Paul Finley was outspoken, not afraid to buck his own party. That earned him some enemies along the way. Mark DePew is director of oral history for the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, and he recently sat down with Paul Finley. He joins us now to talk more about the late congressman. And Mark, a good term for Paul Finley probably was the term maverick.
Well, maybe to a certain extent. He certainly didn't start that way. I did this interview in 2013, so that's 6 years ago, but he was well into his 90s by that time and still very sharp. He was your conservative Republican, the traditional conservative Republican at the time, definitely in the fiscal sense. And it was really early in his time that he saw some of the things that were going on in the civil rights movement, and he started to change his views on some subjects, and the civil rights issue was certainly one of those.
Now, you talked to him about an incident that stood out to him.
A friend of mine here in Jacksonville took a Boy Scout troop to Southern States one day and reported their experience. And they would stop at a gas station. There'd be a toilet for whites, toilet for blacks. And that puzzled the scouts. They couldn't understand that difference because they weren't used to it up here. And that got me to thinking, and I changed. I think one of my first major changes and my attitude on what the federal government should be doing was civil rights.
Mark, Paul Finley talked in there about the fact that he was content, at least in the beginning, to leaving civil rights up to states. But that incident was one of those that changed his view. He had experiences in which he was not afraid then to change a position.
He's serving in Congress during the 1960s, and by the time you get to the end of the 60s, it's a tumultuous time for everybody. And he was not in favor of the Vietnam War, which was contrary to most Republicans. He was a strong proponent for the War Powers Act that came along in the early 1970s. He was actually responsible for the reading of every soldier, Marine, sailor, airman who died in Vietnam on the floor of the House, to make sure that their names, that they were recognized in that respect. So that was part of the thing that maybe he was parting ways with the Republican Party to a certain extent. But there was people on both sides. And this is a period of American history where you could find very conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. But what was interesting for Paul is he had this evolution in his own views and his own positions on things.
Now, he was a small-town newspaper publisher, Pittsfield, Pike County, then rising up to being a player, really, on the world stage.
Absolutely. And he had something, a reputation, that certainly in agriculture he was a strong proponent, although at one point in his career he decided that the big farms were getting too much of the federal subsidies, and that didn't especially endear him to some of his constituents. And part of the political fascination with him as well is, you know, he had to deal with redistricting because Illinois was losing districts in that time. In 1960s, it affected one of his campaigns in 62 of a tough reelection campaign for him. And then in 1982, that was part of the reason that led to his demise, I'm afraid.
You talked to him in 2013. How did he view his career overall? Did he feel there were some missteps there? Did he feel that he made some enemies that he shouldn't have made? Or was he pretty satisfied?
I think overall he was very satisfied with his career. He became well known, I should say, because of his position on Palestine. And he'd gone over in 1974 to help one of his constituents get out of prison in South Yemen. And it was that time he first started to experience the Arab world. And by 78, he was advocating that the United States should talk to Yasser Arafat. There's no reason we shouldn't talk to him. Well, at that time, we weren't recognizing PLO. We had no relations with the man. And that certainly got him in trouble with some of his constituents. But it really got him in trouble with the Israel lobby. And so much of what we know today and his reputation is tied up with that particular issue of being at odds with the supporters in Congress on Israel.
We're talking with Mark DePue. He's director of oral history with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, discussing Paul Finley, the late congressman from Jacksonville. He died earlier this month at the age of 98. You mentioned, Mark, his conversations and his push to have more communication with Yasser Arafat, the PLO, and how that got him into some trouble with people. During your conversation, some people, I guess, had viewed him as anti-Semitic for some of his stances at the time. He bristled at that. He talked about how he'd like to be remembered.
If I am remembered, I'll probably be remembered as one who is hostile to the state of Israel, and I wouldn't like that characterization. I'd rather be remembered as one who fought for the dignity of all people, regardless of race or color, religion. And the reason I'm drawn to the Palestinians is that our country has turned a blind eye to their suffering, and not only that, we have financed the government that has brought most of the misery upon them.
And he stayed active in Palestinian issues throughout the rest of his life. Long after he left Congress, he was still had contacts with the Arab world and was proud about those contacts. He was one of the founders of the Council for the National Interest, which was a pro-Palestinian, I guess, or certainly taking a different track on what was going on in the Arab world. And he was also involved with the Council for American-Islamic Relations, which certainly didn't endear him with a lot of conservatives and certainly the Israel lobby then and now.
I'd mentioned earlier he served for 22 years. He started in 1960 in the U.S. House, representing the Jacksonville area, West Central Illinois. He also ran in 1982 when he was defeated by Dick Durbin, a very narrow race. So here's Dick Durbin, now the U.S. Senator and considered one of the top leading politicians in the country. But it was a really close race. Paul Finley was defeated. I think it was less than 1% of the vote.
Yeah, and that was an interesting race. It was following a redistricting. And I think the Democrats smelled blood in the water as far as Paul Finley was concerned. He was vulnerable. And so they redrew the lines. The Democrats were in control of redistricting that year because of the peculiarities of how redistricting happens in Illinois. Made it a little bit more of a Democratic district. And then apparently the Israel lobby, AIPAC, reached out to Dick Durbin and asked him to run against Findlay. As we know, with Findlay lost that election, Dick Durbin won. And then he obviously moved on to much bigger things as far as his own political career was concerned.
You talk to a lot of elected officials in your line of work doing the Oral History Project. What about Paul Finley and your conversation with him stood out to you?
Guess his optimism, his inherent optimism, and his sense of humor. It was most of these folks, it's just a lot of fun to sit down and talk to him. But he was gracious, extending a welcome to me. I went over to Jacksonville, and he had a little of a museum over there that we sat in his office slash museum, you could say. He had this couch that belonged to Abraham Lincoln that was in prominent display. And one of the fascinating things about him was he launched his political career in 1960 by stringing along a series of quotes that were taken out of speeches that Abraham Lincoln had given. And that was basically his stump speech. He would go out to various places and had all these things memorized that Abraham Lincoln had said, and that rang for the audiences that he was dealing with. And one of the things that he was most proud of, I think if it was to look at what his legacy was, he knew it was going to be tied with Palestinian and Arab issues in Israel. But the other thing he was very proud about was that he was the driving force, one of the main driving forces behind the Park Service, the National Park Service, taking over Lincoln's home.
And he used the civil rights issue, I believe, quite often to bring up Lincoln as well. I think he said at one point he felt, what should the federal government be doing? He thought Republicans should be leading the way because they're the party of Lincoln.
Yeah, Gerald Ford had a different view of that in the early 60s when they were getting to the civil rights votes. As you mentioned, Paul Finley basically said, what would Lincoln want us to do? We're the party of Lincoln. We should be taking positions that are progressing that particular issue. In fact, one of the things that a humorous story he told, and this is, gets to his sense of humor, that deprecating sense of humor that he had. He was such a proponent for Lincoln and such a fan of Abraham Lincoln that at one point in time, when he was involved with getting the recognition for the Lincoln home area, he borrowed the inkwell that Abraham Lincoln had used to sign the Emancipation Proclamation and took it in some of the events. It was down in the St. Louis area, left it in the airport at St. Louis, and then rushed back when he realized what he'd done, and it was gone. And so what would anybody do? Well, what he did, I think this took courage. He called the TV stations and asked them to play some kind of announcement appealing to the audience to say, anybody who found this, would you let me know and so I can get it back? And fortunately for Paul Finley, because he was in the midst of a reelection campaign, a young boy had found it in the phone booth and given it to his dad, and his dad made the connection for him.
An honest person was found, right? When we look at somebody like Paul Finley today and the way he went against his party's leadership at times, and, you know, you can say whether he was right or wrong in some cases, this was a bygone era almost of politics.
Yeah, and I'd mentioned earlier that this is a time frame when you can find the whole political spectrum in both the Republicans and Democratic Party. And that was very much the case at the national level and also at the state of Illinois level.
We've been talking with Mark DePue. He's director of oral history with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. We've been discussing the career of Paul Finley, the congressman from Jacksonville, who died earlier this month at the age of 98. And all of that interview that Mark did with Paul Finley, available with others at oralhistory.illinois.gov. Mark, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
The law legalizing recreational marijuana in Illinois takes effect next year, and it calls for expungement of criminal records for some past convictions involving possession of marijuana. One of those working on that is the Winnebago County State's Attorney, Marilyn Height Ross. She told Guy Stevens the law presents something of a challenge for the community.
Even though Illinois, effective January 1 of 2020, has legalized recreational marijuana, it still remains a Schedule I controlled substance federally. And so individuals need to understand that they still could face federal prosecution for possessing marijuana.
So what do you see as positives in the law, as well as negatives?
There are positive areas in the law which indicate that they will, in fact, channel a lot of the taxing dollars into those underprivileged areas and allow businesses to be owned by those individuals that were previously impacted by a marijuana conviction. That could be positive if, in fact, that does happen. However, I certainly wish that and hope that some of those funds could also be channeled to law enforcement and education, because I perceive that law enforcement will be taxed with illegal grows that will spring up. They may not have the resources, and certainly with children, there should be some component of education for the harm that could be caused you know, children's brains are underdeveloped. There's, you know, science that says that marijuana is a drug that could inhibit brain development in children. So certainly I would hope some of those resources would be channeled towards that as well.
How are you planning to implement the law?
What I have been looking at and have a plan in place for is the expungement that will be required for those individuals who were convicted in the past or who received court supervision for possessing less than 30 grams of marijuana. I'm currently meeting with law enforcement officers. I've already met with my narcotics unit to try to flag those cases that are coming in currently and that will be newly filed through the end of the year so that we can be proactive in making sure that we address that component of the statute regarding expungement of records.
Are there other actions you're considering when you talk about policies or community outreach or education? Have you fleshed out any of those ideas yet?
Yes, I have. I've actually reached out to some of the state representatives and some of the local leaders to put together an educational forum for the community. I want the community to be fully advised that legalizing recreational marijuana does mean that other laws are not still in place. For example, reckless driving, driving under the influence. Again, there are certain categories of that that remain in place, and individuals should understand as well that employers can still set the tone in their workplace. They can still require individuals to be drug-free, and certainly with certain professions, you would expect employers to do that, such as law enforcement, medical providers, offices such as myself. There are restrictions on licenses. There are restrictions on who can grow marijuana. You can't just have your own garden, a pot in the backyard. So I think it's important for the public to understand that.
Is there an issue that you feel should be addressed?
I would hope that the state of Illinois would learn from the opioid crisis that just because it's legal doesn't mean that it's safe. And I think individuals still need to take care in the use of marijuana if they decide to do so, because they could end up in a crisis, as we have seen with the opioid crisis, where it is legal medication, but it had a high potential for abuse and lives were devastated and communities have been impacted.
That's the Winnebago County State's Attorney Marilyn Height Ross. She spoke with Guy Stevens. You're listening to Statewide. Next are active shooter drills for students doing more harm than good. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. Just ahead, how an effort to help the homeless has some residents of a Springfield neighborhood concerned. And is the state's budgeting for results experiment working? That and more on the way. A new state law requires students in Illinois to participate in an active shooter drill. It takes effect this upcoming school year. But as Lee Gaines reports, some parents and mental health care experts worry the drills may do more harm than good.
Rebecca Marshall is picking up her 5-year-old from day camp at the Champaign Park District in East Central Illinois. Today's activity, an active shooter drill. Marshall is anxious.
I didn't know how to prepare him for it. And I didn't want to tell him that it would be scary. I just kind of wanted to see how he felt about it, because it's terrifying to me.
But her son, Malcolm, seemed fine with it.
I know that you guys did a drill today. What happened today?
We tried to hide from Miss Kalo. And we locked the door and Miss Kalo said, open this door.
Malcolm says he wasn't scared. He thinks the drills are good. Why?
Because it's just practice, and practice is good for you.
This isn't the last time Malcolm will have to do an active shooter drill this year. A growing number of states now require schools to conduct them. In the last 2 years, 8 states, including Illinois, either passed or updated laws that require these drills. Since 2013, Illinois school districts have done active shooter drills, but they didn't have to involve students. Last year, however, lawmakers passed a bill that requires students participate in these drills. And not every kid responds to them the way Malcolm did.
So Rory is our beautiful daughter. She is 7 years old and going into second grade.
That's Diane Gordon. Her daughter, Rory, is a student at Champaign Unit 4 Schools. Last spring, Rory experienced what school district officials call a hard lockdown drill. Students are told to remain silent and keep calm.
It was heartbreaking. She was screaming and yelling, She loves school, and she kept yelling, "I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back."
Rory is an anxious kid. She's on the autism spectrum and has ADHD. Gordon says Rory worried about bad people with guns for weeks after the drill.
If she saw policemen on the street who have, you know, guns, of course, in their belts, she would get really upset and say, "Mommy, there's a bad guy. There's a bad guy." And I don't want her ever to think that the police are bad guys for her. They are supposed to be the safety guys.
Gordon doesn't think kids should be involved in these drills because of Rory's reaction and the lack of data to support how effective they are.
Fair enough, but an emergency can happen at any point in a school day.
That's Melissa Breimer. She's with the National Center for Child Traumatic Stress. The group offers guidance on how to implement active shooter drills in schools without traumatizing students.
Because we can't predict when an emergency is going to happen, it is important to make sure that students know the basic steps of what to do in case there are these times when an adult isn't present.
Breimer says these drills can save lives without hurting students if staff are trained in coping skills and parents are informed. But there's no studies to prove this. Stephen Schlossman says it's easier to study the effects of these drills on kids. He's a child psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital and the co-founder of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds. He says these drills can be challenging for kids with anxiety and developmental disorders.
Despite people being super careful to make this a more palatable exercise for them, they still get pretty, you know, at best unnerved and at worst, pretty traumatized.
Schlossman says most children are like 5-year-old Malcolm. They take these drills in stride, but he worries about children like Rory.
I don't know that we do ourselves any favors with these drills, but I do think that that train has left the station. Like, I can't see them stopping that.
Meaning he thinks the drills are here to stay. For Rory and her mom, Gordon, there's a caveat in the Illinois law. School staff can exempt some students from the drills. Gordon hopes that will be the case for Rory. She says the potential cost to her daughter's mental health is too great to risk it. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
9 years ago, Illinois passed a law saying state spending should be based on merit, not how much a program or agency got the year before. It was called budgeting for results, and it was slow to get going. But as Brian Mackey tells us, things are finally picking up speed.
When budgeting for results was becoming the law of the land, one of its main backers promised Illinois would fund programs based on performance and impact, not politics and special interests. A year later, then-Governor Pat Quinn touted budgeting for results using the past tense.
The budgeting for results process focused all of us on our core priorities and increased openness in the entire budget process.
But that might have been a bit optimistic. While it's true that work was beginning, it was still a long way from transforming the state budget. And frankly, it still is.
Building a performance-based budget system for a state the size of Illinois, which operates on a line-item budget, has been a challenge.
This is Kurt Clemens-Mosby, director of the Budgeting for Results Unit in the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. In the early years, the problem was figuring out what to measure. 7 broad categories were identified, including education and public safety. Then every dollar in the budget was linked to a program. After that, perhaps the biggest challenge is shifting the mindset of how to measure performance. It's easy to count what officials call output indicators, like the number of people who participate in a program. But that doesn't say much about whether people's lives are being improved.
This is a difficult process because we have to balance the need for quality outcome measures with the cost and burden on agencies and their clients.
Nevertheless, budgeting for results took a big step forward in 2017 when it chose a cost-benefit analysis tool. Now, analysts are working their way across government. First up were the Departments of Corrections and Juvenile Justice, where programs were rated effective, moderately effective, or marginal, which is a barely passing grade. Alexis Sturm, Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget director, says those evaluations are already affecting policy decisions. Take adult education programs in the prisons. Because they were found to be effective, corrections asked for more money.
To the extent that we were able to do that, you know, we were able to direct additional funding for that program.
In the marginal group, however, was electronic monitoring. This is where devices track the locations of parole violators and other high-risk parolees. Now, it's not like this prompted lawmakers to zero out funding, but it is giving at least some of them pause.
I mean, there was a time when we thought, and I'll just say it this way, that we thought a key to reducing the prison population was electronic monitoring. You know, and now we've seen reports to suggest that it may not be as effective as we thought it was, so to speak.
State Representative Will Davis is a Democrat from Homewood. He says budgeting for results seems like the appropriate way to budget, but there's a caveat, namely a concern over whether data should trump personal knowledge.
And sometimes possibly these performance type ways of allocating resources don't necessarily always fit with what I think is happening in my communities or how I feel the dollars should be spent.
Still, Davis says budgeting for results needs to be ramped up more quickly than it has been. One of his budget-minded Democratic colleagues, State Senator Heather Staines of Chicago, says the General Assembly is set in its ways.
We're going through our line items and we're doing it that way. We're not doing it at this moment in time based on how effective the programs are and how are we, you know, trying to really address a desired outcome. That culture shift hasn't happened yet.
With corrections and juvenile justice in the books, budgeting for results is moving on to state-funded substance abuse programs. Later, they'll tackle things with even bigger price tags like public schools and state universities. The goal is that someday, sooner than later, every dollar Illinois spends will be justified based on performance. I'm Brian Mackey.
You're listening to Statewide. Springfield's Zoning Commission will be considering the location of a new center for health and housing. The center would provide emergency shelter, health care, and other services for those experiencing homelessness. As Daisy Contreras reports, homeowners say they're opposed because they've been excluded in the early phases of the project.
Tracy Shaw is a member of her neighborhood association.
I've lived in Springfield over 50 years now in that same area, and it was not called Pioneer Park at the time that we moved here, but I've been here that long.
On a recent weeknight, I joined her and some neighbors outside the Boys and Girls Club. Popcorn and root beer floats met those who wanted to stop by and chat. Shaw and other members are collecting signatures on a petition to stop the zoning change for a former state office building on the corner of 11th Street and Edwards. That's where the Planned Center for Health and Housing would go.
When people don't know what you're doing and how you're doing it, and they have not been engaged to help with solving the problem, you can't expect them just to go along.
Shaw says they are not against helping those experiencing homelessness. Still, she points out, the East Side has about 14 other service providers, and the community wishes for some of that to be spread out to other parts of the city.
And so we are at a place now where we're not going to go along, and we're raising our voices, and we think we have a valid issue.
Bob Palmer is the policy director with Housing Action Illinois. He says he's seen similar reactions in other communities.
There might be pressure to locate programs that serve people who are homeless and provide affordable housing away from where other people are living.
But he says that's often not a good option because that means services are far away from public transportation, job opportunities, and other resources.
I think the key to addressing the concerns is, you know, public education and open community discussions.
That open community discussion started with a town hall 3 weeks ago, and some residents say that was too late.
You know, I think we do have to apologize and say this: the conversation didn't happen in the way that we had hoped it would.
Erica Smith is the executive director of Helping Hands of Springfield. She's spearheading the project with Southern Illinois University School of Medicine and other partners. She says the struggle has been timing.
Before you go to people, you have to have a proposal in place that has some sort of feasibility. Those elements didn't line up until recently. As soon as they lined up, we brought this to the public.
Smith says the plan would solve many of the issues residents are already facing, from seeing loitering in their backyards to panhandling. She says the center would have multiple services under one roof, including 24-hour security and outreach. Smith says there are backers who are willing to fund the center. But now all that's needed is the zoning permit. And for that, the Springfield City Council has the final say. Springfield Mayor Jim Langfielder says he's heard concerns about the current location being close to a middle school and a preschool.
You know, I want them to go through the process. It's not Jim Langfielder's opinion, but it's everybody's opinion.
Ward 2 Alderman Sean Gregory says he is still talking with residents and service providers about the plan. He says he still doesn't have a position. But homeowners like Tracy Shaw say the conversation should not exclude the mayor or citywide officials.
It is an issue that has to be addressed by the whole city in order to come up with a solution. And the homeless are not just on the east side of Springfield. They are throughout this community.
Shaw says residents just want to be heard.
I would just urge them to talk to the people in the community and get their input. And maybe they'll be able to change some people's minds. You never know.
The center is on the agenda for the Planning and Zoning Commission meeting on August 21st. I'm Daisy Contreras.
Presidential candidates have been fanning out across Iowa, meeting voters and finding out what's important to them. Amy Mayer with Harvest Public Media reports that's an opportunity to get agricultural issues on the national agenda.
Iowa's first in the country caucuses are less than 6 months away, and this time around, there's little competition on the Republican side. But more than 20 Democrats are vying for their party's nomination. University of Iowa political scientist Tim Hagel says it's a heady time to be an Iowa voter.
And the joke always is, you know, if you ask one person in Iowa, New Hampshire, have you decided on a candidate? No, I've only met them, you know, two or three times.
Iowa went twice for Barack Obama and then for Donald Trump. Democrats hope they can win Iowa again, so candidates are trying to attract voters who aren't committed to either party by showing they care about Iowa interests, like agriculture. On a hot 4th of July, a crowd mingled in a private yard ahead of California Senator Kamala Harris's stop in Indianola, a small city within commuting distance of Des Moines. Corn and soybean fields stretched around two sides of the property. Warren County boasts a couple of outlying suburbs of Des Moines, but most of it is still farmland. Kevin Peterson isn't registered with either party. He's listening to everyone. He says hot-button social issues probably aren't what he and his neighbors will base their decisions on.
The economic issues, when they're going to make a significant impact to a rural area or semi-rural area like Warren County, is probably going to sway things a lot more in 2020.
Peterson's not a farmer, but he wants to know what candidates plan to do about trade deals, which some argue have disproportionately hurt farmers. In Corn Belt states in particular, the slashing of soybean exports to China has stymied farm profits. Voter David Kitsis has seen the impact.
Farmers need help right now, big time. And current administration's not doing it with the tariffs with China, and so we've got to get somebody else in there.
Harris came prepared to address Trump's ag policy, even referencing soybeans rotting in bins because farmers didn't have a market for them.
We've seen a president of the United States who came into office saying that he was going to protect farmers. Yet, he initiates trade policy by tweet.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar toured an Iowa ethanol plant in April and declared support for the renewable fuel standard, a law popular with farmers because of the demand it creates for their corn. In 2000, Republican candidate John McCain essentially skipped campaigning in Iowa because he opposed ethanol subsidies. Other candidates are taking on the merging of large agribusinesses. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says if she's elected president, she'll undo the completed Bayer-Monsanto merger.
Remember, you can continue to consider the monopolistic impact of these mergers even after they occur. So this is not one of those where, darn, now it's happened, and so there's nothing we can do but wring our hands.
In the July debates, agriculture came up only a few times. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan called for a more sustainable agricultural system, and former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke specifically mentioned cover crops and conservation easements. But the lack of primetime attention underscores the role of early state voters. Again, political scientist Tim Hagel.
It does give voters a chance to raise those issues before the candidates and give the candidates an opportunity to consider those issues that they might not consider in another state.
Hagel says that can result in pandering, but Iowans have a long memory for those caucus season promises. Obama, for instance, had a tough re-election campaign here.
He made an awful lot of promises as a candidate and was not able to follow through.
President Trump came out in favor of ethanol ahead of the 2016 Iowa caucus. He didn't win it, but Iowa's Republican senators have made a point to hold him to his commitment. Hagel says that's the sort of legacy the Iowa caucuses can foster. But it's not clear whether any issue will rise to that level for Democrats in 2020. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
This is Statewide. Next, getting Carbondale ready for the 2020 census. A report is on the way. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a dangerous stretch of road in western Illinois has led to some students becoming activists for change. That story coming up. The 2020 census is coming out in April, but why is it important and why should everyone fill it out? Well, for Illinois Issues, Benji Jeffords takes a look at how groups in one southern Illinois town are working to spread the word in underserved and often undercounted communities and why it matters.
Across the country, groups like the Carbondale Census Complete Count Committee are forming. Their purpose is to make sure everyone is counted. Their town and people depend on it.
There's a lot at stake. The census really determines how the funding is distributed through communities, whether it's social services, transportation. A number of things are determined by your population.
Committee Chair Chris Wallace meets with the group once a month to discuss ways to reach those who are considered historically undercounted. These are groups of people that don't mail back their census form, which leads to census workers going door to door to try to get them counted. They include college students, minorities, retirees or snowbirders, the homeless, people that live in large apartment complexes, and people born in foreign countries. Father Bob Flannery with St. Francis Xavier Catholic Church is also on the committee. Before their first meeting, there was already a controversy brewing over a citizenship question the Trump administration wanted to add. Father Flannery knew this would prevent some residents from participating.
What about the immigrants? Because I knew that some people would be cautious about responding. In a household be one person that perhaps is undocumented. Well, if that happens, none of the family is going to want to be counted or be part of the census because they're fearful for their own safety or the safety of their loved one.
Ultimately, the Supreme Court decided the citizenship question will not be on the census.
Is anything that would be in any shape or form, way, shape or form, would prevent somebody from considering being counted or doing the census is against what the Constitution is saying we need to do.
To find out why residents in these groups don't participate, I spoke with Maria Taylor. Originally born in Ecuador, she first came to the U.S. as an exchange student. Now, she's a U.S. citizen. She volunteers with the Southern Illinois Immigrant Rights Project on their education committee to help immigrants through the process of gaining residency and citizenship.
As far as the census, as I was talking to you on the phone, I did reach out and asked several of my students were citizens, and I asked them if they could come talk to you. They still didn't want to.
What was the reason they didn't want to?
They have previous generations that are not safe yet.
The fear of not being safe had an impact on the number of households that mailed in the self-response questionnaire. Jackson County had a self-response of 76%, and Union County had a 84% self-response.
They tell me that the previous census, their parents and their grandparents had received the census. And they partially filled out, and then they said, why are we filling this out? It's not going to apply to us.
As the 2020 census approaches, the focus is shifting to educate the historically undercounted on the importance of the census and what happens when they don't respond.
And I think that our job is going to be to make them aware that if they don't fill it out and send it in, somebody's going to come knocking on the door. Would they be more comfortable with the knock on the door or just send the paper out?
Taylor asked her contacts about how they feel participating this time around.
She said several of them said they're more at peace now that the questions are not there, so they were probably filled out.
There's also another fear about filling out the census. Chairperson of the Southern Illinois Immigrant Rights Project, Becca Tolley, says this issue is not isolated to the undercounted populations.
I think in general there may be hesitation about how information might be used, given some of the administration's policies. And so that's why we really do want to make sure people understand the strong safeguards on information that is given to the census.
That's the reason Sally, who asked us only to use her first name, has never filled out the census. She works at a resale shop in Union County and has a lot of apprehension about filling out the form.
Yeah, because when it asks that, it's asking for the names and all kinds of different questions about them, and it's not their business. I don't know where that information goes, right?
Okay, so that's a main reason why you don't want to
Yes.
fill out the census.
Yes.
Taylor says lingering questions about where the information goes are a huge hurdle in getting an accurate count, and along with other groups, they are trying to ease the minds of those who are skeptical about the census.
They're not dispersing this to anyone else. I think that's the big part of the misconception, that the information gets spread out, but it doesn't. All they want is the statistics.
Talley says those statistics determine how hundreds of billions of dollars will be distributed across the country, and it will affect everyone.
That includes money for health programs, school lunches, programs for disabled veterans, you know, schools and roads and investment in that.
Wallace says participation should be easier this time because the 2020 census is going digital.
So this is the first time that you'll be able to register online. It's always been a paper form in the past. So that online registration is going to be, I think, an asset.
Wallace and his committee feel this will improve the accuracy of the count.
I think it helps us because we can mobily connect people to the internet. We can knock on somebody's door with a tablet and have them fill the form out right there.
I'm Benji Jeffords.
A state requirement says all pregnant women in Illinois must be screened for depression as part of their prenatal care. A new research study from the University of Illinois finds those screenings may overlook a significant proportion of women who have suicidal thoughts. Social work professor Karen Tabb led the study, and she spoke with Christine Herman about the findings.
You find that women with depression were 13 times more likely to report suicidal thoughts, but at the same time, I think it's important to point out that more than a third of the women who reported thoughts of self-harm did not have elevated levels of depression. Why is that significant?
From a clinical standpoint, you would expect women who are experiencing elevated depressive symptoms to possibly also be experiencing things like self-harm or harm to others, so suicidal ideation. We are a bit surprised that so many of the women who reported suicidal ideation were not having those other symptoms of depression, such as anger, sadness, irritability. They were simply reporting thoughts of self-harm. As a part of the state mandate, there's no required tool. So the state doesn't say what you must use to screen and the manner or form by which you should screen, but it says there are some suggested instruments. So in our region of central Illinois, many people use the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale. The Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale is unique in that it asks about suicidal ideation as the last item or item 10 of the questionnaire. And not all tools are going to ask about suicidal thoughts or self-harm. Another tool would be the Patient Health Questionnaire. The 9-item version of this questionnaire has one question about suicidal ideation, but not all clinics use that tool.
Yeah, so would you say that that's what really needs to change? Is that the takeaway from this study, that the way these mental health screenings are done, if they're not using a tool that specifically looks at suicidal ideation, some of these pregnant women might be falling through the cracks?
Yes, exactly. Right now in our maternal mortality crisis, we're trying to find all of those risk factors and all of those predictors that we can use to reduce those risks for death in the first year after delivering an infant. So suicide is up there. In the United States, it's the third leading cause of death in the first year. That's not a physiological complication. If we can screen women for suicidal ideation during pregnancy, we can capture a unique subset of women who are going to have those greater risks when they go home with infants.
Yeah. How does being a mother yourself affect the way that you approach this research?
I really appreciate that question, Christine. So I've been doing this work now for 11 years. And I approach it differently now that I'm a mother myself. Screening is one of the most important tools that we have to identify women in need of further support and resources during the perinatal period and to address one of the most common pregnancy complications, which are perinatal mental health disorders. So now that I am in clinics myself, I see the process more intimately than I did when I was just thinking about the importance of screening. I've heard from clinicians for several years, and we've done some research about the comfort level that providers have in delivering the screen. But now, as a patient and mother, I've seen that level of discomfort and the providers with high levels of comfort discussing mental health issues such as depression and anxiety during pregnancy. We have a lot of work to do in terms of providing support to the clinical providers or the clinicians to be more effective using the screening tool, to know how important it is, to know how to have a conversation about it.
That's U of I social work professor Karen Tabb. She spoke with Christine Herman. Route 34 in western Illinois is a four-lane highway with a median from Monmouth east to Galesburg, where it connects to Interstate 74. It's also four lanes in Iowa, from Burlington west to Des Moines. But much of the stretch between Monmouth and Burlington is two lanes, with no median, not much of a shoulder. Those who live and work in the highway corridor say it's a dangerous rural road. They say 8 people have died on it since 2013, and around 90 others have been hurt. Rich Egger tells us those who live in the area are hopeful some improvements might soon be on the way.
Among those with the loudest voices about the issue are students who are not yet old enough to drive on the highway.
We need persistent people continuing to push for these projects and push for improvement.
That is Allie Strack. She will be a freshman this fall at West Central High School in Biggsville. Strack says she has witnessed the problems that can come with a narrow two-lane highway.
We were going into Burlington and there was someone on the side of the road and their tire exploded while they were driving and they had to keep going because there wasn't anywhere to pull off yet.
Strack's classmates say they've had their own close calls. Keegan Thacker says she was in a car that hit a deer while returning home from a basketball game.
The deer flew off of our car and went into the other lane, and another driver hit it, and it was scary. We pulled off onto, like, the grass, and, like, as we were standing there, semis were, like, flying by before the cops got there.
Thacker, Strack, and some of their classmates are members of the student group 34 Voices, and they're making sure their voices are heard by the state's decision makers. Members traveled to Peoria this spring to testify before an Illinois Senate panel. The students taught lawmakers about the issue and explained why changes are needed. And now that Illinois has a capital projects bill for the first time in years, funding for those changes could be in the offing. However, those changes will come too late for Michelle Schnicker of Burlington, Iowa.
February 11th of 2013, I lost my husband. My late husband died on that highway.
She says Doug Schnicker might not have been killed if Route 34 was a four-lane highway.
My husband did the best job that he could to try to get his vehicle off the road, but the semi had come clear across and there was nowhere for him to go.
Schnicker says she made a vow to herself and her family to work to ensure that no other families suffered a similar loss. As part of fulfilling that vow, Schnicker helped revitalize the 34 Voices group. It had fallen by the wayside after several years of lobbying by students who graduated and moved on without seeing much done to improve the highway. Now that 34 Voices is active again, the students are emphasizing that a wider, safer highway will benefit more than just local communities. This is Caden Drosty, who's about to begin his freshman year at West Central.
Semi drivers that have to drive across the country use Highway 34. It's going to benefit everyone in the long run. If this gets done how we want it to be done, this 20 miles can help insane amount of people.
He says that even includes people from communities such as Macomb, which is a good 30 miles south of Route 34. Macomb Mayor Mike Inman concurs with Drosty's point.
One of our largest manufacturers here in town, Pella Corporation, all of their materials come from Pella, Iowa across that road to support this plant here, and their finished product goes back to Pella, Iowa for distribution across those roads.
Inman says a four-lane Highway 34 would also make it safer for college students from southeast Iowa to travel to and from Western Illinois University. A new school year is about to get underway. Summer break has come and gone, and there is no word on whether the Route 34 project made the grade with the Illinois Department of Transportation. That state agency will decide which road projects get the green light for funding. And until the funding comes through, the students, Schnicker and others, say they will keep promoting the many reasons why they feel improvements should be made to that 20-mile stretch of Route 34. Rich Egger reporting.
That wraps up this week's Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and tune in again at this time next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And be sure to check out the website, statewideshow.com. All of our episodes, including this one, can be found there, and our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.